Blog Talk Radio.
And so of you will be kicked and
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy. I am especially pleased to share that we are back. Yay! It's been three long weeks, but you know what? Everybody needs a vacay. Tim took a couple of weeks off, and then Tim comes back, and he's roaring to go, and it's like, oh, I'm taking a week off, too. But we're back. 3 weeks. But we are here, and Tim, it's great to hear your voice. How are you?
Yes, indeed. It's great to hear your voice again as well, Kel, and I'm absolutely unbelievably fine. And how about you?
Well, as usual, I am infidelity well.
Hey, how about that? Yes, it's been a wonderful couple of weeks vacation. I've been in wild and woolly Wales, which for some of your listeners who don't know exactly where that is, it's the lumpy bit that's pinned onto the side of England. And it's actually, you know, quite nice when you get out there and, you know, you get into a field and there's sheep wandering around and, well, you know, it's just a very, very nice holiday. So, but it's good to be back. And I understand you had a great time with a fishing holiday. Is that right, Kel? You went on a fishing holiday.
I caught a pair of Louis Vuittons.
Oh, well, that can't be bad. I mean, you know.
We had some very nice day trips, but the weather here in Canada was rather unkind to us, shall I say. And we were in the in Fahrenheit, 50-degree weather some days. So it really put a kibosh on some of our aspirations, as it were. But we did. We had a very fine time. We've got Dobby Amber home, and he's acclimatizing very well. Mm-hmm. He and Freya are getting along swimmingly. And he's right here with me. I don't know what he's looking for food.
And Dobby Amber.
No, it was a nice recall. It was
Dobby Amber is your new bloodhound, isn't he,
yes.
For our listeners? Yes. Very good.
Right.
Your cat loves him.
A week and a half ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a big boy, 62 pounds. And Holter thinks that I actually adopted a baby cow because I was showing some pictures, and he's like, holy crap, look at the size of that dog. It's huge. But he's doing quite well. And that was nice, though, that we had the week get him used to being in the household, and he and Freya bonding, which they are. And he really does like being with us. He's resting at my feet right now as we speak. He doesn't like being left alone. He's very much a pack dog, but he bays. He howls.
Mm-hmm.
He howls, yeah. We take him to the park, and he sees other dogs, and he wants to run with the pack, right? And he's loud. But he also did something that pleased me the other day, and that is a true-to-form bonding. Somebody approached the house, probably somebody just dropping off a flyer or whatever, and he barked. And Mr. Cal was a little concerned about that, and I said, no, this is exactly what we want him to do, is to warn us when somebody gets too close to the house. He barked, let us know that somebody was approaching his house, so we know that he's totally, totally assimilating himself into the household. So that was the best part of my vacation, other than the weather, and that was a very long way of telling you, Tim, how I spent my vacation.
Well, yes. I mean, it's always nice to hear these heartwarming stories about animals bonding. You know, I mean, we used to have a cat, and we brought a dog into the house, and we thought, well, how are we going to get these two to bond? But, you know, once I got this cut price pack of super glue, it was easy. And, you know, from then I never looked back. So, yeah, you know, I know how important these things are, Kel.
You know you're terrible, right?
Well, anyway, I just, you know, I can imagine all your listeners now will be going, oh my God, what's the number for the RSPCA? You know, we're going to have to get this, guy arrested.
You will, and the people are going to say, it's that cat strangler guy.
Yeah, that's right. That's him, officer. That's him. he's been doing all these terrible things. Arrest him. Arrest him at once. So,
you'll be standing there, you know, surrounded by the authorities, and you'll be saying, stand back from the violin case.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a cat here, and I'm not afraid to use it. So, yes.
But we are I'm so happy that we're back on the air together, as opposed to you doing something and then I'm doing something and this and that and the other thing. You were quite missed, I must say, there, Mr. Burton.
That's nice to know.
We're asking in various chat rooms, when is Tim back? When is Tim back? I think they show up for you, you little showcase.
Well, I'm sure that's not true, Kel. It's your dulcet tones.
I'm sure
tones.
It's not either.
Yeah. If your dulcet tones are after, I'm sure that's what it is. But we've got, there's been a lot happening in the wonderful and wacky world of Islam over the past two or 3 weeks. In fact, we're spoilt for choice, I think we have to say, what with the goings on in Iraq and Syria, with ISIS declaring the caliphate, with all the happenings in Nigeria and Boko Haram, various horror stories coming out of various other parts of the Middle East, like Afghanistan, and of course all the things that are happening in the UK and Europe as well. So there's absolutely no shortage of things to talk about when Islam's involved. It's the gift that keeps on giving, as we like to tell everybody. Isn't that right, Kel?
Absolutely. And you have been quite busy with a Brenner Brief. You have been writing articles, and you're getting a lot of positive feedback about what you have been doing in terms of dealing with the Trojan horse investigation in Birmingham, and we're going to touch on that one a little bit later. But there's one that you brought to the table, and this is from Blazing Cat Fur, and this article about the Afghanistan a girl who is trying to keep her safe after she was raped, the family wants to honor kill her. Like, well, what is going on with this? This is from Dr. Hasina Sarari. He's the head of the Women for Afghan Women, and they showed photos of a girl who reportedly was being raped by a mullah. Okay, I mean, we understand that we have people in positions of trust, and we have seen those positions of trust violated, and we have readily condemned it. But this seems to be okay within the realm of Islam in that they can attack with impunity, and it is sanctioned. Now, this case happened in Kunduz, Afghanistan, and it's bad enough that the alleged rape took place in the sanctity of a mosque and that the accused man was a mullah who invoked the familiar defense that it had been consensual sex. Oh, come on. The victim's only 10 years old. Now, what is going on here is that the authorities said her family members openly planned to carry out an honor killing in the case against the young girl. The mullah offered to marry his victim instead. Now, this past week, what's happened, the awful matter has become even worse because on Tuesday, local policemen removed the girl from the shelter that had given her refuge and returned her to her family despite complaints from women's activists that she was likely to be killed. This is a day in the life of Islam. This is yet the latest. You're right. I can't shake my truncheon and not hit an atrocious story coming out of Islam, Tim.
I mean, this is something, of course, that has been the case for a long, long time, and it's worth going over these stories, not necessarily because we can actually do anything constructive about them, because by the time these stories get reported, the damage has been done. Quite often in a case like this, a girl who's been subject to this kind of treatment will have been on a killed, almost pretty much straight away a lot of the time. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be reporting on it, because it's Islamic culture that's at the bottom of it. All the commandments that are in the Quran and the instructions on how Muslims should live their lives and how they should treat others, they lead to the kind of things that we see all around the world. And we really ought to report on them, because our political elites are trying to impose Islam into Western societies, and it needs to be resisted. And we don't we have a lot of people who will say to us, well, the only reason that you're resisting Islam at all is because of racism and Islamophobia. And we need, at every stage, we need to say, well, no, that's not the case. We're resisting it because it's a backward, barbaric culture that contributes nothing to humanity and has no place on the face of the earth. 1400 years on, we have developed a far, far better civilizational model than Islam can ever hope to aspire to. And we have to stand up and say that civilizational model is not just an equivalent multicultural concept. It is superior. It is better. It is far better than anything Islam can ever offer, because Islam cannot be reformed. It was designed not to be reformed. And the only thing we can do, if we can't wipe it off the face of the earth completely, is to make sure that it affects as few people as possible. And certainly we should be starting with our own environment and protecting our culture and our civilization against what is turning out to be easily the most barbaric culture and civilization. Well, use the word civilization loosely. It's certainly a barbaric mm-hmm. culture. It's a very poor civilizational model, and it is unfit for human consumption in the 21st century. So if we can prevent it or turn back the tide of Islamization where we are to start with, and there's every reason to do that, then we then stand a much better chance of being able to take our own civilizational model and hold it up as an example for others to follow in different parts of the world at some time in the future. Now, I know that's what George Bush tried to do when he went into Iraq and imposed democracy on everybody and thought they would take to it overnight. Well, we know that isn't going to happen. But what we can do is demonstrate that there are far, far better ways of doing things than the Islamic way. And we have to find ways of actually selling that to people and saying, if you want to live according to Islamic culture and civilization, well, you do it on your own without any help from us. And it should be conditional. If we're going to offer aid to overseas countries, it should be conditional, certainly, on them not supporting terrorism against the West. But we ought to be trying to wean them off Islam in every way, shape and form, in every way we can. Now, that isn't going to happen overnight. It's probably not even going to happen in a generation. It might take 3 or 4 generations. But unless we've got that vision of bringing enlightenment to these dark parts of the world, we're never going to get anywhere. We owe it to humanity to take our enlightened vision and make sure that it is allowed to flourish throughout the world. And, it's like a tender plant. You can't just stick it in the desert and expect it to grow. It has to be nurtured and watered and protected against the winds and the snow and all the forces that would destroy it. But we have to try. We owe it to humanity to try. So every time we come out with one of these stories from Afghanistan or Pakistan or one of the Middle Eastern countries that show the barbarity and the brutality of Islam, we're not doing it for no reason. We're doing it because we owe it to humanity to expose that barbarity and brutality and show people that there is something better.
And that is it. This is what we strive to do. we come across these stories, we can relate individual stories 24/7. This one in particular, though, really stuck with me, and when Tim sent it my way, it bothered me greatly. Tim, is you're so totally right on the mark that we do owe it to humanity, because that's what we are. We're humanitarians. And to come across these stories of little children being, subjected to such abuse at the hands of an entrusted one, and then to add to the barbarity that, the family wants her honor killed. And Dr. Hasina Sa'ari, she tried to protect this young girl, and she was told to back off. She was driven into hiding at one point by death threats from the girl's family and other mullahs. They wanted to play down the crime by arguing, the girl was much older than 10, please. There was one militia commander who sent Dr. Sa'ari threatening texts and an ultimatum to return the girl to her family. And now this doctor wants to flee Afghanistan. The head of the Women's Affairs Office in Kunduz, Nedera Gaya is her name, mm-hmm. who actively campaigned to have the young girl protected from her family and the mullah prosecuted. She resigned on May 21st and moved to another part of the country. This is the day in the life. This is absolutely horrific, and how come we are not seeing this in mainstream media? Because mainstream media are too busy reporting on Kanye West and that Kardashian whore. They have no time. They have no time for the issues that literally mean life and death for these people. And later on, Tim and I, we're going to move into another story, which is in total contradiction of what we're trying to do. And this is a women's group that is demanding Sharia law. We'll move into that one a little bit later. But this is aberrant. It's an atrocity. The resulting support for the mullah and for the girl's family and its honor-killing plans, it's emblematic of a broader failure to help Afghan women who have been victims of violence, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, you can understand to a certain extent why that happens, because there is a lot of it's a lawless country, and Americans or any well-meaning people from any Western country who try to help in the past frequently have found themselves kidnapped, and in some cases, you know, they've been either ransomed or murdered. And you can understand there's a lot of angst amongst Americans and people who would like to help but feel that, you know, they could be kidnapped and killed at any time. And if that were only, you know, the case that it might happen very rarely, that would be one thing. But it seems to be the rule more often than not that something like that will happen if you're perceived to be a Westerner trying to change the ways of that particular country. I mean, there are hundreds of stories. But I can think of plenty where aid workers who've been doing nothing more than trying to improve the general health of people in Afghanistan have been kidnapped and killed. Polio workers, I'm not sure if that's so much with Afghanistan as much as Pakistan. I know it's true of Pakistan. Polio workers have been kidnapped and killed because they believe the residents of the country believe that injections and treatments to help a disease which ought to have been eradicated from the face of the planet a long time ago. They believe that it's un-Islamic to try and treat these diseases in that way. So they kill people who are there purely to try and help.
Yeah, and so, what I understand too is that they have they are fearful that it is also some sort of sterilization.
Well, there is that, because they don't understand the science behind it. There is often the thought that they might actually be trying to do something that's going to harm the person that's having, say, an injection or whatever it is. I mean, to be fair, that is not just confined to Islamic countries. I remember during the Vietnam War, 40, 50 years ago, there were stories coming out of American humanitarian workers who were trying to give children injections into their arm. And I think it might have been for polio. I can't be certain. But the point was that they came back sometime later to find out how the kids were getting on. And in whole areas, they found that kids who had these injections had their arms hacked off with machetes. So they had, a load of one-armed kids running around because the natives of the area thought that the Americans might be trying to poison their kids by injecting them. Well, what can you say? I mean, it's a horrendous thing to happen, but maybe it shows that you can't just go in there and apply Western rules without some form of education. And that education is going to take, well, I say forever. It's going to take generations. It is not going to be solved overnight. And I think Westerners who go in and think it's going to be solved overnight are really causing more harm than good. But that doesn't mean that we oughtn't to make everybody aware of how things really are in those parts of the world, so that when we do come to do things which we hope are going to benefit people in those parts of the world, we do so with the maximum amount of knowledge that we can possibly have of what might go wrong. Because at the moment, we are guilty of going in there and applying our own rules and thinking that they're just going to accept them overnight without any sort of argument at all. But now we know that isn't the case. We might have to plan ahead. We might have to plan ahead 20 years if we really want to improve the lot of these people. And, they live a barbaric lifestyle. In comparison to the lifestyle that we're lucky enough to have in the West. And a lot of them will not see the advantages that we see of living in the West. They'll say, well, we like the way we do things here, and that is a mindset that isn't going to be changed overnight. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, only that we should try with the appropriate knowledge and not just assume that everybody's going to think the same way that we do.
And one thing, too, that is disturbing about this story in particular is the Afghan by women for Afghan women. They do get funding from the United States, but as the United States withdraws their troops, there are sharp reductions in funding, and these advocacy groups are drying up. They are being left, again, to fallow. What's going to happen, like you say, it does. It takes generations to turn these sort of issues about. We will not see it in our lifetimes, nor our grandchildren's lifetimes, perhaps, but at least we have a legacy that we can leave behind to educate and ensure that the West does stand up to principles. But they're being left, like I say, to fallow. The United States has withdrawn, Canada's withdrawn, Britain has withdrawn. Afghanistan, rather, is back to its post-1960s, 70s state. This is unacceptable to me, in that we have invested so much time in trying to ensure some sort of stability, but you're right. They do not understand democracy. It's foreign to them, and they resent it. They don't like it. And this is how we're going to move into our next segment in a few moments. But what we have achieved, nothing. I don't think we've achieved a darn thing. I think the only thing that we've achieved is that we have garnered world exposure as to what exactly goes on within Islam. This is what we do, you and myself. This is all we can do. Our governments have failed miserably. As a matter of fact, they have made things worse. There is open contempt for the West, as there should be open contempt on the West part when it comes to Islam. What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I was just trying to think how best to follow that up, because I was just looking at another associated story with this, which mm-hmm. really shows that there's a lot of pressure to bring back cultures, to bring back norms which are really foreign to everything that we've been trying to show people in that part of the world. This was a story to do with Syria, and I think you were going to touch on that later. And it seems that whenever Muslims have the opportunity to do so, they will try and revert back to applying Sharia law, because they think that it is a perfect divine system of governance that cannot and should not be challenged, and that anything else that gets in the way of Sharia law is really innovation or bidah, to give it its Arabian, to give you the Arabian word, the Arabic word, I should say. Anything that we try and do that we think would be maybe a fairer, more humane way of doing things, to even show them this, without the other infrastructure that's that we've all grown up with a mindset that encompasses a complete infrastructure. When we talk about law and order, we have a good idea of what that means. But underpinning that law and order is a culture and a mindset which is completely alien to anything they have in the Islamic world. And you can't just impose our own ideas of law and order and other associated Western concepts on people who don't have that mindset and that idea of what constitutes a good culture. I rather think I was straying away from your question there. So if I've missed off elements of what you were asking, you want to sort of elaborate a bit more, I'll pass the mic back to you for you to do that.
Nope, you are on the mark with my query. But what I find, maybe I'll go to sidebar just for a second here, because I have a very, very disturbing I can't explain this phenomena. This is nothing like we've ever seen. I know that the internet exposes a lot of these atrocities, but we can talk about the atrocities, but you're right, it's the mindset. We're not going to change hearts and minds. And I am now discovering that when the troops come home, they're speaking horror stories. And we speak, of course, with Michael Green, who works closely with the wounded warriors that come home after a theater. But it's the mindset. It just cannot be changed, because the mothers even believe that there is no choice but to kill rape victims who are seen as unmarriageable and would therefore be a lifelong burden to the families, and that it would be a constant reminder of dishonor. And quote-unquote, their men feel they have to wash their shame with blood. We are witnessing honor killings, of course, in the Islamic world, but we're also seeing them here at home on our Western shores. Why is it that we cannot put a moratorium on Islamic immigration and carbosh it? This is not conducive to the Western host countries.
It's not. And the answer to that is we should be putting a moratorium on Islamic immigration. What we have done is to open up our borders to people, again, who do not share our mindset and our culture and our notions of democracy and the way that our civilization ticks along. All right, some people say, well, it's not perfect, and I'd be the first to agree with them. But it's a darn sight better than anything, in my view, that has gone beforehand. And it should not be allowed to be supplanted by an Islamic culture and an Islamic civilizational model, which is vastly inferior. But that's what our political elites have been doing in the name of multiculturalism. They're saying, oh well, all cultures are equal, and we shouldn't judge. Well, I disagree. I think we should judge, and we should say. It's not difficult to give lots of examples to bolster what we say. We should say our Judeo-Christian culture and civilizational model is far superior to anything that Islam has to offer. And although people who come into our countries might think that they want to live by their own civilizational standards, we have to say, well, if you're going to bring it into the public space, that is going to be absolutely not allowed. And if you can't accept that, then it's probably better if you go and live in a country where Islamic morals, ethics and values form part of the public space and not bring them over here. And if our politicians weren't so craven and cowardly, we would have done that as soon as it became apparent that there was a problem with Muslims in particular not integrating and not assimilating into our countries. Now we've got a much bigger problem than we would have had 20 or 30 years ago. And I guess what a lot of politicians thought was in the intervening 20 or 30 years, well, you know, they're going to integrate and assimilate eventually, because every other group that has come to live in the West, you know, they've integrated and they've assimilated. But the political elites have made a lot of assumptions about Islam because they don't understand it. They haven't bothered to look into the texts and the tenets and the atmospherics of Islam and what makes Islam tick compared to what makes a culture and a civilization like Judeo-Christian culture and civilization, what makes that tick. And because they haven't looked into it, they've just made an assumption that all cultures are the same. They've allowed Muslims to come in, and they're realizing belatedly that there's a huge problem. When you allow Muslims in any sort of volume, you're going to get major, major problems. You know, when Muslims are less than 1% of the population, it doesn't look like a problem. It looks like they're just a colourful minority. You know, they've got exotic food. And, you know, they're generally pleasant people when they're less than 1% of the population. But when the population increases, as I'm sure I've explained to our listeners before, and if I haven't, then there's an excellent study by a chap called Dr. Peter Hammond called What Islam Isn't. When you start going above 1%, the dynamics change, the paradigm changes, and Muslims become much more aggressive, and it gets worse and worse and worse, almost exponentially as the population increases. And even that wouldn't be so much of a problem if it were not for the fact that the demographics of the situation, where Muslims reproduce far rapidly than the Western European populations, typically 4 or 5 children per Muslim couple is normal, whereas for us it's much less than the replacement of 2.1 children per European or indigenous European couple. It might not sound like a lot, but if you do the mathematics, what it means is that in a couple of generations, you completely transform the whole nature of the societies in which you've got a mixture of Europeans and Muslims. And at that point, things start to get very nasty. And if you want to see how nasty they can get, well, just take a look at Syria and Iraq now. Just take a look at Lebanon, which was majority Christian at one point. But once Muslims started to flex their muscles, everything went downhill from there. And there was a 20-year civil war from which Lebanon still hasn't fully recovered. And now it's a majority Muslim country. And Christians who were present in that country, who weren't killed, have fled elsewhere. And the picture will be the same on our own streets and in our own towns and cities if we allow the present state of affairs to continue. So the very first thing we should do is have a moratorium on Muslim immigration, as you say, Kel. And then we should really be understanding the differences between Islamic culture and our own culture, and between the Islamic civilizational model and our own civilizational model, and the morals, ethics, and values that each of those civilizational models promotes. And once we've got a full understanding, then we can start reversing the trend. At the moment, anybody who tries to stand up and say the trend should be reversed, like you and me, we get called racists, Islamophobes, fascist, bigoted, intolerant, right-wing, and so on and so on and so on. But it's purely because nobody really understands or even wants to understand that there is a major, major difference. And it's a difference that we haven't encountered in the West before and are only belatedly realizing that there's a serious problem. But the knee-jerk reaction of our political elites is to say, let's not talk about this problem, everything will be fine. And, you know, in the short term, this week, next month, next year, you probably won't see, you know, a great deal happening. But our children and our grandchildren will see it. And when you're looking at two generations down the line, the life in European countries where you've got a majority of Muslims or, you know, maybe not a majority, but 30 to 40% of Muslims, life is going to be very, very different. And like I say, if you want to see how different it is, just look back in history to places like Lebanon, and that will be our streets, our towns, our cities in two generations' time. So it is important that we talk about these things, we bring it out in the open, we make criticism of Islam a normative thing to do. At the moment, if we try and criticise Islam, we're quite likely to be taken to task for it. Some of us will be arrested, charged and prosecuted, mentioning no names. But we have to change the entire atmosphere so that it becomes normal to criticise Islam. It becomes normal to raise the fact that Muslims in particular cause problems because they don't integrate, they don't assimilate. All right, a small percentage do, but when you're talking about pretty much every survey shows a huge, huge number of Muslims that do not want to assimilate, they do not want to integrate, they want Sharia law, they think it's perfectly acceptable to kill people who criticize Islam. We have to say enough. If you subscribe to this ideology, and it is an ideology, not a religion, a totalitarian political ideology, no less, we have to recognize it for what it is, not for what we would like it to be, but for what it actually is. And once we get that accepted, that criticism of Islam is okay, that we recognize it for what it is rather than what we would like it to be, we can start making a difference. But the way to start making a difference is with people like you and me, Kel. We talk about it, we bring our ideas out into the public space, and we invite people to examine those ideas. You know, I'm sure people will come back and say, but Tim, what about this, what about that, what about the other? And I'm all for that. I think if somebody wants to bring an argument back to me and say, well, maybe that's not the best way to look at it, I'm open to anybody coming back and discussing with me the merits of doing things in a particular way rather than the way I'm proposing. But what I'm saying is, if we do nothing and we continue down the road that we are currently continuing down, and we don't have a moratorium on Muslim immigration, then I really fear for the futures of our children and our grandchildren, because it will not be. But, anyway, back to you, Kel.
What I am concerned about in particular, we cannot control what happens in Islamic states. This young girl, 10 years old, being raped by the mullah and her family subsequently looking to honor kill her. Unfortunately, we cannot control that over there, but we have to learn how to control it over here. And one story, when you were talking, Tim, the one story that came to mind was the Shafia family murders. And this is Canada has the dubious distinction of having the first mass honor killing by Islamists in the Western world. And just to give a brief overview, the Shafia family murders, they took place on June 30th of 2009 in Kingston, Ontario. There were three sisters and the first wife. The sisters were Sayyid, 19, Sahar, 17, and Giti, who was 13, along with Roma Amir Mohammed, who was 50 years old. They were found dead inside a car that was discovered underwater in front of the northernmost Kingston Mills lock at the Rodeo Canal on the same day. Zainab, Sahir, Giti, they were daughters of Mohammed Shafia, who is 58, and his wife Tuba Mohammed Yahia, who was 41 at the time. The couple also had a son, Hamad, who at the time was age 20. Rona, who herself was infertile, was the first wife of Mohammed Shafia and their polygamous household. On July 23rd of 2009, Mohammed, Tuba, Yeha, and Hamad were arrested on charges of 4 counts of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder under the guise of honor killing. They were found guilty on all 4 counts by the jury in January of 2012. The trial, which took place at the Frontenac County Courthouse, was believed to be the first Canada conducted in 4 languages, English, French, Dari, and Spanish, because of the witnesses. One of the girl's boyfriends was from Spain. This garnered a lot of media attention because Canada had never experienced anything like this. But we have seen other cases of honor killings in Canada. We are familiar with so many of them, as has the UK. But, Tim, I have something here, and I want to play this for the listeners. I'm just going to buffer it up.
To see this and hear about this story, why did prosecutors come to the conclusion that the girl's father and mother and their brother had killed them?
You know, from the outset, Aaron, it seemed that they just did not believe this family, didn't think that they were acting like a family that was grieving, didn't think they called police in time. It just didn't add up. But they really took what was an extraordinary step here, and that was to wiretap the family, crucially, in their own minivan. They got them to come back to the scene of the crime. While they were looking at some of the details with police, they bugged their minivan. Explosive evidence from this. According to the prosecution, they say it incriminates the entire family in terms of how the conversations went on. Let's give you some of it, Aaron. It really is hard to believe if this is what the prosecution is alleging. But Mohammed Shafia, the patriarch of the family, is said to say, "I say to myself, you did well. Would they come back to life 100 times? You do the same again." And then in alluding to the kind of rebellious acts that he found out about his daughters, they were dating Western boyfriends, they were dressing in a way that he didn't approve of, he said, "May the devil defecate on their graves. This is what a daughter should be. Would a daughter be such a whore?" And you can imagine if you're that jury sitting in there and listening to this, and believe me, there are hours of wiretap conversations, you're looking for explanations. The other thing that doesn't add up, the damage to the other family car, that Lexus. What the prosecution say they did is that they tipped that family car with those 4 women inside it over into an open canal, and those women drowned.
And let me just ask you, I know that they're saying, right, that they were traveling on a family trip together, all of them, in 2 cars, right? So that's where they said that they literally would have pushed it. And I believe, Paula, that also it appears that the daughters and the stepmother were beaten, right? I mean, that it looked like they perhaps had been beaten and unconscious and then put in the car.
Well, look, this is contentious. A lot of what's going on here is circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They're asking, where is the evidence that how these women died? Pathologists testified that they had fresh bruises. At least 3 of the 4 victims had fresh bruises. No way to explain. And the defense is dismissing that, saying, look, if you were going to have these 4 women and you were going to try and kill them beforehand, these defendants had no time to do that. And they say, look, were these women just going to stand there being, in the words of the defense, like lambs to slaughter? No, that wouldn't have happened. And yet the jury, time and time again, has listened to this little dance between the prosecution and 2 of the defendants that took the stand, and their stories, the prosecution says, they just don't add up.
Paul, what would be the punishment if they are convicted?
Definitely life. We don't have the death penalty here in Canada, but definitely life in prison. It's an interesting way that they prosecuted this. The prosecution has had all 3 defendants up there. The defendants have stayed together. their stories, while contradictory, they are all saying they are innocent. It isn't that one tried to break off from the others pleading to any kind of a lesser charge. Aaron, you can't help but be riveted by the details of this. These girls, beautiful, intelligent girls, and the kinds of things that they were saying to family members and social workers even beforehand that they wanted out of this house. All right, Paula, thank you very much. And
it cuts off there, Tim. But, yeah, at the very end, when you listen to that clip, these young ladies and the first wife, they were all looking for help. They were running to shelters. They were going to their high school counselors. The first wife was speaking with somebody out of the United States, trying to figure out how to get out of this terrible situation. Nobody listened to them because of cultural sensitivities, and because of cultural sensitivities, four women died violently.
Yeah, I mean, this is the huge problem with multiculturalism, is that it doesn't do anybody any favors at all. We should be standing up and saying, we have a better way of doing things. We have a better culture. If you are sensitive or you don't like the way in which, you know, you come to our country, but you don't like the way that we look at your culture in comparison to ours, we should be saying, well, that's just too bad. We have a better way of doing things, which we think everybody should follow. In fact, we expect it. We expect it that everybody follows the laws of the land, and part of the law of the land involves treating everybody equally, and that's a two-way thing, really. We expect the authorities to treat us equally, but we also expect that when we integrate, talk to or do anything with our fellow man, we expect that they will not suddenly pull out a knife and stab us because we've said something they didn't like. We have certain expectations, and if people are not willing to accommodate the way that we do things, you know, we can respectfully ask them to go and leave by the next plane, and don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. We have the right to expect that. We have the right of self-preservation of our culture. And what our authorities, our political elites, have been trying to do is to take away that right of self-preservation and say, well, you are not going to be allowed to defend your culture, your way of life, your civilization. We're going to let these barbaric 7th century savages in, do exactly as they want. We're going to give them houses, welfare benefits, we're going to let them jump the queue in everything, and the indigenous people of this country can just put up with it. Well, that is not going to be a solution for long-term community cohesion. And if community cohesion is what our politicians really want, then they're going to have to go about it somewhat differently, because it just isn't going to work. One of the things, of course, that's brought into sharp relief the fact that having a large Muslim population is not the unbridled success story that Tony Blair and politicians in Britain and Europe have been telling us it is for the past 10 or 15 years. The protests that in major cities in Western Europe concerning Israel and Gaza, the Israel-Gaza conflict, all of a sudden politicians are waking up to the fact that large number of Muslims are demonstrating on our streets, and they're not doing so in a peaceful manner. They don't really have the tradition of demonstrating peacefully. It's a less than stellar track record, if you get my drift, and they will become violent at the drop of a hat. I mean, you and I know this, but our politicians are now finding that when you get a common cause for Muslims to rally round, that they can become very violent very quickly. And we've seen huge protests in pretty much every major European city over the past couple of weekends. And in fact, the politicians in France have become so frightened of what might happen is they have actually banned pro-Palestinian protests. Yeah, good luck with that. Because what mm-hmm. we found, of course, is that last weekend, even though there was a ban on pro-Palestinian protests, And the authorities said to themselves, well, you know what we have to do? We have to threaten them with large fines and long prison sentences. That's what will make them frightened. And of course, with Muslims, it don't quite work like that. If they get the bit between their teeth, then long prison sentences and fines are not going to frighten them. And what we saw on French streets last weekend was certainly a significant amount of violence, so the smashing up of Jewish businesses and the attacking of synagogues, and all of it looks like it's going to get a lot worse, and they're not put off by the prospect of like a 15,000 euro fine or a prison sentence. I mean, for a lot of Muslims, of course, you know, they don't have 15,000 euros, so why would they worry about a fine? They're just not going to pay it. And as far as prison sentences are concerned, well, you try locking up large numbers of Muslims and you see what happens inside your prisons. They know that they can get away with doing pretty much whatever they want. And the civil authorities, like the police and the courts, they're going to be virtually powerless to do anything about it. All right, the police might fire off a few tear gas rounds, but, you know, it's all a good weekend's fun for your average red-blooded Muslim in the streets of Paris. You know, have a running battle with the police. You know, you chuck a few rocks here, smash a couple of Jewish businesses windows there. It's all jolly good fun, you know. And if you get arrested and you're faced with a threat of a prison sentence and a fine, well, so what? That is not a deterrent for a Muslim mob. And the French authorities, I'm sure, are going to be forced into a position where they've got to, if they're going to save anything at all of their capital city, they are going to have to get a lot firmer. And I'm talking maybe you know, bringing in the military and enforcing a curfew, and it's actually going to come to, you know, death on the streets. So I have no doubt about that, because once Muslim mobs get blood, they smell blood, as they are smelling blood now, because what's happened is, up to now, our authorities in not just France but throughout Europe, they've thought, well, you know, we can cope with a few Muslims here and there. They might make a bit of a fuss every now and again, and they might go around beating up some of our citizens and making life unpleasant, but what the hell, you know, we'll keep a lid on it and everything will be fine, and eventually we'll retire and we'll get our pensions and we can leave the country to be run by somebody else, which is an entirely immoral position to take for anybody who's tasked with looking after the country and defending the long-term interests of their citizens. They are just not doing it. They're abdicating their responsibility. And I'm talking about politicians all over Europe, not just France, not just the UK, but pretty much everywhere in every Western country. But what something like this is going to do is to make them realise that Muslim mobs are not going to be cowed by the threat of fines and jail sentences. That won't happen. The protests will get worse until they are put down with extreme violence. And, you know, people are going to die on the streets, without a doubt. But it need not have come to that if political elites had learnt from history and said, well, we're just not going to allow Islam to establish a presence in our country to the point where something like this could set them off and they could become a major national security threat. But, you know, we are where we are, and it is a major national security threat. France that's the first European country to have banned the protests. Much good may it do them, I say, because I'm looking at some pictures that Paul Alexander has posted from a link in the mm-hmm. chat
yeah.
room.
Paul Alexander is brilliant. His website is fantastic. And
cpnagasaki.wordpress.com. Yes. We've got the
got
link,
it.
Haven't we? Paul's posted it in the chat room. And yes, thank you very much for that, Paul. That's very much appreciated. And it does go to show that when you get a Muslim mob on the rampage, the threat of fines and prison sentences is not going to deter them at all. I mean, it might deter some of them, but there's still going to be a core presence on the streets of thousands, if not tens of thousands, and I think that's only going to get worse, because the Israel-Gaza conflict is not going to get better anytime soon. In fact, you know, I rather hope that Israel go in there and clear out Gaza completely of and you know, retake that they, I mean, they might have to completely reoccupy Gaza under military occupation. Well, that would be an ideal long-term solution, because originally, when the partition of Israel and the other areas in the Middle East, I mean, we're going back a long time, obviously, but
yeah,
what was originally
UN world, post-World
yeah,
World.
What was originally envisaged was 80% of the land being given to the Arabs and 20% to the Israelis, and if that had been accepted at the time, well, things might have been different, but in fact, if I remember rightly, the Arabs weren't happy with that. So it ended up that Israel ended up with a very tiny percentage of land that was going to be just for them, and the Arabs got the rest. And it would not be unreasonable for Israel to take the entire population of Gaza and boot them into Jordan and say, right, you take care of them. You know, you can set up a refugee camp, you can assimilate them and integrate them into your country, do whatever you want, but they are not staying on our land. Because what is obvious is that you can give away as much land as you want to Muslims. As far as Israel is concerned, they gave Gaza back in 2005. They gave Gaza to the Gazans and said, you know, here you are, make a success of it. We'll even give you all sorts of goodies to help you. I think Bill Gates gave several million dollars. All sorts of Jewish businesses gave assets away to the Gazans to give them a start. They could have said in Gaza, we're going to become, I don't know, the Middle Eastern tourist capital of the world. And people would have flown in from all around the world to show them how to do it, you know, and giving them help free of charge. People who run successful tourist businesses elsewhere in the world would have given help free of charge. They decided not to do it. They could have said, well, we're going to become, you know, the greatest industrial capital in the world, and they could have had all sorts of help from people around the world, and they decided what would be far better would be to build rockets and dig tunnels and make life miserable for Israelis, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. But anyway, that's enough about me on the Israel-Gaza conflict. Kel, I'm going to hand you back the microphone.
Yeah, I think that what I want to do is I want to take a little bit of a break so that everybody can refresh their coffees, teas, whatever it is they're imbibing in.
Yep,
and,
okay.
I really want to come back, though, and touch on what you were talking about in terms of the incompatibility of Islam in the West. But there's also something else that we should talk about, and this is the all-female Islamic State Brigade that is enforcing Islamic law on women. And this is from Jihad Watch, so we'll touch on that one as well. But when we come back after break, Tim, I really want to talk about the incompatibility of Islam in the West, and then we can move into this story a little later. But
Sounds good to me.
All right. We'll see everybody back here in 3.5 minutes. And, Tim, I specifically chose this song because what you were discussing about us being humanitarians, we are. And we are the keepers of the faith, and we are the keepers of humanity. So I think that this song is totally appropriate. This is The Keeper by Chris Cornell.
This road to become a battlefield. genocide. Well, laughter meets fear. Confusion all around as I try to feed these mouths that have never known singing. And before I let one more tear hit the ground, I will be the one standing between you and the sound of the rounds echoing out, out of the dark. The smoke and the spark aimed at the heart of the flame. I am a keeper. The end of the tunnel tonight. My eyes are weary. And before I let one more life get erased from the ashes, I will rise for you and the ghosts of names, faces and frames, love and the pain. For you I'll remain, though I'm not worthy of keeper of the flame. I am the keeper, yeah. I am the keeper.
Welcome back, everybody, and you're listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. Tim and myself, we are back after a hiatus, and if you scroll up and look into the show highlights, I will tell you that Tim and Kel return to the airwaves with a renewed determination to inform, engage, and educate about the greatest threat facing the planet today, and that is Islam. Tim, we were talking about the incompatibility of Islam in the West. I related, of course, that specific story about the Shafia mass honor killings. And as you know, because you know I had worked with Pamela Geller in the past and Robert Spencer in the past with Axel Parvich, who was honor killed in Canada as well. So you know that this sort of thing is very close to my heart. Why is it? I want to take this a step further, and I want to expand on something. The mm-hmm. Shafia family could have been saved. They were screaming, literally screaming for help, as was Axel Parvish, and nobody listened to them. The authorities wouldn't listen to them. Nobody would hear their pleas. They were saying, help me. I am in peril. My life is in peril. And the authorities would not listen here in Canada. I'm sure that that is also the case in England, and I'm certain that it happens in the United States as well. I think, of course, that it has everything to do with cultural sensitivities and official multiculturalism, as we're seeing in Canada. Official multiculturalism is something that has got to be avoided at all costs. We're seeing what official multiculturalism is doing to the fabric of the Canadian society as a whole. And there are some cultures that are less equal than others, but there seems to be very much a reticence on the part of the authorities to deal with the underbelly of Islam in the host countries. And Tim, I was wondering, are you seeing more and more activity in the sense in the UK?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you can see the effects of political correctness and multiculturalism everywhere you look. There was a phrase we used to have. I don't know if it's still in common use now. That you couldn't swing a cat without hitting whatever it was, you know, you were looking at, or you couldn't shake a stick at it, but or without you know, knocking it in half. But I've got an example which I can talk about. It's not as drastic an outcome as with the Shafir family, but it's a story that I've been following in the UK for a couple of months, and it's about an investigation that's called the Trojan Horse investigation, and people who live in the UK will probably know about this. And the reason it's got so far as it has is because of the effect of political correctness and multiculturalism, where nobody, the people who were in charge, who were charged with protecting our culture, protecting our civilization, enforcing rules and regulations, and they should have been there to prevent what was actually happening, they were too scared to do anything because of the culture of political correctness and multiculturalism, too afraid of being called racists and Islamophobes to do their jobs properly. And instead of doing their jobs properly, they just projected these accusations of racism and Islamophobia onto everybody who complained about this particular set of circumstances, which I'll outline briefly in a moment. But if anybody complained about it, they were tarred with the brush of racism and Islamophobia. And in certain sectors, including the sector I'm about to talk about, that can be a career killer. The Trojan Horse investigation was centered on a series of schools in Birmingham. And the allegation was made that some hardline Islamic fundamentalists who were employed at senior teacher, head teacher and governor level at schools in the Birmingham area were trying to enforce Islamic norms on pupils, and they've been doing it for some time in a very stealthy and covert way, so as not to bring too much attention to themselves, and they were having a lot of success. And there was an anonymous letter that came to light saying this was what was happening. On the back of that, the education department, headed up at that time by Michael Gove, decided to order an investigation. Of course, very first thing that happened was there were cries of racism and Islamophobia, not only from the teachers involved, but for people in authority in and around Birmingham who ought to have known better. The Bishop of Birmingham, he said, you know, this is all a storm in a teacup. It's racism and Islamophobia, and you know, we should stop it immediately. The head of Birmingham City Council said, yeah, it's all Islamophobia. We're being tarred with we're being tarred unnecessarily. It's just a witch hunt. Obviously, the teachers and the governors and so on said the same thing, but even the chief constable of West Midlands Police, a chap called Chris Sims, said it was all to do with racism and Islamophobia. And it was very unfortunate that the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, had decided to bring in a chap called Peter Clark, who is a retired counter-terrorism officer, because it sent out all the wrong signals. You know, people will be demonising Muslims again. Oh, yeah, as if Muslims weren't demonising themselves enough already, of course. But this is a perfect example where our children's future was being systematically undermined and jeopardized by this small group of people who were intent on imposing an Islamic agenda throughout the school. And I've been writing substantially in Brenner Brief about this. I've got, let me just see if I can find, yeah, here we go. I'm just going to bring up a link, which is probably one of the latest links in the story. But I've written maybe 8 or 10 articles on this particular story over the last couple of months. And as the story has developed, you can see very clearly what is going on. And first of all, this letter comes to light. It's written anonymously. People say, oh, it's a hoax. It's just racism and Islamophobia rearing its ugly head. And, of course, you've only got to mention those two words in the education sector, and everybody goes, you can't say that, racism, Islamophobia. I don't want to be called a racist. I'd better pretend it's not happening. And they do that because they can get fired. They can get fired overnight if they are seen to be in any way racist or Islamophobic in the way that they deal with things. Somebody's only got to say, I was treated in a racist or an Islamophobic way, and people fall over themselves to make sure that no Muslims were offended. You know, you could almost see a sign going up in the on the outskirts of Birmingham, on every major road leading into Birmingham, you know, saying no Muslims were offended during the course of yesterday or something like that, you know. Everybody is falling over themselves not to offend Muslims. And, of course, Muslims abuse that, and they do all manner of things that people like you and me, or adherents to the dominant Judeo-Christian culture, if we do anything like that, we are very rightly taken to task. But Muslims, it seems, up till recently anyway, they can get away with an awful lot. Now, the more this investigation has gone on, the more the role of political correctness and multiculturalism has been exposed, and people are starting to realise that political correctness and multiculturalism is a you know, it's a very bad thing. And did I put this link in? I can't see it again. I'll put it in the chat room again. Apologies if I've put it in twice. But I put one link in specifically about the Birmingham City Council and the Trojan Horse investigation. And I've got another one, which is a general essay on political correctness and multiculturalism. I've a feeling I've put that in twice. So if I have, I apologise to everybody.
I put the link in for Brenner Brief/Tim Burton. Go to BrennerBrief.com, author Tim Burton, and all of Tim's articles are right there, and you can click on all of them. Believe
me. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. But that's really great. I really appreciate that. The thing about the Trojan Horse investigation in particular is every article I write, I reference all the previous articles as well. So anybody who's interested can go back and see the way the story has progressed. And it's, you know, it's quite obvious that political correctness and multiculturalism has played a huge part. But the very latest thing that we had happen last week, I mean, all the reports came out and they said that Peter Clark's counter-terrorism guy, he produced a report and said, yep, it's definitely been happening. There's been a definite attempt to subvert the educational system, and, you know, something should be done about it. And there was an Ofsted report by the Department of Education, which came out, I don't know, about 6 weeks ago, and that said, yep, there's definitely some grounds for further investigation here. And then there was Birmingham City Council's own report. Birmingham City Council, of course, are the people who've been letting all this happen under their noses, and predictably their report said, problem? What problem? There's no problem here. It's all racism and Islamophobia, I tell you.
really?
But, of course, the way the story has unfolded, you can see the truth of it all. And it is down to the fact that, well, first of all, the allegations were certainly true. There was a plot going on. And people did not want to do their jobs because of political correctness and multiculturalism. And I've talked about it all in some detail in these essays and in these reports. And I won't sort of go through every single one right now, but if anybody's got any questions, I'll try and answer them while we're on air. What the latest was that happened last week was that the Board of Governors that was at the center of these allegations, they resigned. They cracked under the pressure and they resigned. And a jolly good job too, because the Board of Governors included a chap called Tahir Alam. Now, for anybody who doesn't know Tahir Alam, he's got form. He's a hardline Islamic fundamentalist who has done his level best to try and get Islamic influence increased in all sorts of areas in and around the Birmingham area. So he got himself into a position as a governor in the Birmingham education system, and he was fingered as being the ringleader of this, quite rightly, and he has actually resigned. But some of the teachers, apparently, under a deal that's being done, and I don't know the full details of the deal that's being done, they might actually get to stay in their jobs on the basis that they're competent teachers. Now, I actually disagree with this, and I've written a little note at the end of my last report saying, being a competent teacher should not excuse you from suffering the consequences of your actions. If you've been involved in covertly subverting the educational system, you know, that is not a minor transgression. You know, it's not like forgetting to order the right number of pencils for your class or something like that. It's a really, really, really serious thing. And if we don't send out an example discourage this sort of thing from happening in the future, it will undoubtedly happen again. But as things develop further, I'll be producing more reports for Brenner Brief, and you know, the story I'm sure hasn't run its full course yet. But yeah, political correctness and multiculturalism, that's just one example of how it can adversely affect the structure of our society. You know, we've built up a way of doing things in our culture and our civilization over, well, I don't know, let's just say over the past 50 years. And by and large, it's not perfect, but by and large, it works for most people most of the time, as long as you have the goodwill there from all the players or most of the players. But when you get a significant number of people, like Muslims, who do not want to play by the rules, who know that they can get away with bending the rules with very little in the way of consequences, then what you get very quickly is all sorts of creaking at the seams, because our culture and our civilization, it might seem very strong, but it's, you know, it's not made of stone, and it doesn't take a great deal for people to actually make it very unwieldy indeed. And that's what's happening with Islam and Muslims at the moment. They are taking the very fabric of our culture and civilization, they're pushing at the boundaries to see how they can get it to collapse, because of course once it's collapsed, they can introduce their own culture and their own laws with Sharia law, and we will all be considered third class citizens when that happens, if and when that's allowed to happen. So we've got to make sure that it never is allowed to happen, and the best way to make sure is by educating people and saying this is the process by which we are having our culture and our civilization undermined. And if we can make that clear to people, it requires freedom of speech, it requires people like you and me and all the people who listen to our shows and all the people in the counter-jihad movement, it requires a certain amount of freedom, the ability to stand up and say, this is wrong, without worrying about whether or not you're going to lose your job over it, without worrying about whether or not you're going to be arrested, charged and prosecuted for what you say. And we've got a little way to go. And there are going to be people who are going to be arrested, charged and prosecuted for what they say. I have already been through that route, and it's quite possible I may go through that route again. But there are people who can't even stand up, and they know it's wrong, but they can't even stand up and say anything because of the risk of losing their job. And you know, for a person who's just starting out in life, or who's got a family to feed or a mortgage to pay, you know, that's a really big deal. And for them to not be able to speak out, you know, that's a terrible, terrible thing. So we all have to play our part in whatever way we can to spread that awareness. And if it means that there are going to be a few casualties along the way, you know, I might be another, then that's just part and parcel of bringing that awareness home to people who are passionate about our culture and civilization and who want to do their little bit to save it. But back to you, Kel.
I am listening to you. You're jogging so many things with me. As you know, I'm involved in very many projects, and I speak with a lot of people that are very helpful to me. And if it weren't for people like you, Vlad Tepes, Michael Green, I wouldn't know where to start with this. But I was speaking with Vlad Tepes on the Skype the other day, and we had a conversation about how do we approach Islam in the West. Of course, everybody knows my stance. I want it outlawed, and this is my letter-writing campaign, that we have Islam de-indexed as a religion. But I was speaking with Vlad Tepes about this, and he said, yeah, you know what? Do what you need to do. That's all very well and good. But what we have to do is concentrate on what you were just saying there, Tim, is that mm-hmm. we have to be able to show open contempt and not be fired for it or sanctioned for it. We should be allowed to express our open contempt for Islam. And this is a very, very, very important angle that we have to take.
Yes, it is. Without a doubt, if we cannot criticize Islam and the Quran and the Sunnah and the Prophet Muhammad and his life and times, and you know, cast aspersions on some of the things he said and did, without Muslims rioting in the streets, then we're going to be in trouble. All right, they might riot in the streets anyway, but the point is, we ought to be allowed to criticize Islam, because in the history of bad ideas throughout human history, it has to be one of the worst ideas ever. It's a very clever idea in a lot of respects, in so much as it was designed in such a way that it could never be reformed, which of course is why people who say, yeah, well, you know, when Islam goes through a reformation, like the Christian Reformation, for example, because people compare it to Christianity because they think it's a religion, okay, then they say when Islam goes through its own reformation, then there will be peace in the world and we won't have to worry. But, you know, it's obviously going to take a few years, so let's just accommodate these Muslims in the meantime. But of course they completely overlook the fact that Islam was designed so that it never could be reformed. Once the gates of Ijtihad closed 1,000 years ago, and by that what I mean is there was a process whereby people could question certain things about Islam over 1,000 years ago, and it could be debated and things could change for certain circumstances if they were decided upon by various learned mullahs and clerics and people in Islamic authority 1,200 years ago. But what happened was that process, ijtihad as it was called, was stopped at a particular point in Islamic history, and Islam became frozen in time. And the reason we see so few Muslim reformers now is that anybody who tries to reform Islam in any meaningful sense is declared as an apostate, and you know, can be killed. And indeed, people are killed for doing just that. You know, you only need some well-meaning Muslim cleric to stand up in a mosque and say something like, "Hey guys, maybe it's not such a great idea to kill all the Jews and Christians." And before you know it, he's being shot to death, and his head's on a spike outside the mosque. And that happens frequently enough for people to say, "Shall I say that in my sermon at the mosque next Friday? Nah, I don't think I'll bother," you know. And the people who might reform Islam or might have an influential voice do not stand up, because they know that they could be killed, or their families could be killed, or you know, pretty dreadful things could happen one way or another. Islam is designed not to be. Sorry, go on. Yeah.
I have a question about that, and I don't mean to interject, but if I don't ask this, it will run away from my my little head. It sounds as though that you're proposing that the imams and the mullahs, that they're intimidated into towing the party line of Islam, as opposed to them actually falling wholly into place with the belief system of Islam.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who look at Islam, Muslims I'm talking about, who look at Islam and say, "Hey, maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be." But of course, they can't say anything to their friends or their family or their colleagues or to anybody in charge who you know, other Muslims, because they know that dire things will happen to them if they do say that. I'm sure there are people who recognise that Islam has a lot of problems, but they know that if they speak out, they're likely to be killed or their family is likely to be killed. And you know, that's a big disincentive for most people, even Muslims. That's a big disincentive. And you do get ex-Muslims, of course. I mean, we had not so long ago, we had the St. Petersburg Declaration, and I do have a link somewhere, although I can't lay my hands on it right this moment. The St. Petersburg Declaration was an attempt by some very prominent ex-Muslims to say, well, in fact, I don't think they were all ex-Muslims. I think there were a few Muslims in there who genuinely wanted reform, and they put their names to the bottom of this document and said, if only Islam could drop some of the nasty bits, you know, like hating on the Jews and Christians and stuff like that, it could be really nice and we could take it forward to the next level and it could, you know, take its place in civilized, in, well, amongst other major civilizations and become part of the great tapestry of humanity in years to come. The problem is that because Islam was not designed to be reformed, in fact, it was designed not to be reformed, would be more close, if you try any reformation at all, you're in trouble because a true Muslim must agree with absolutely everything in the Quran and the Sunnah. If he's going to be a devout Muslim, he has to believe. Now, that is actually in Quran chapter 5, verse 101-102, where the Quran instructs Muslims that they must believe. You must not question what Islam has to say in the slightest fact, because Islam, according to the Quran, is perfect. Everything has been thought of by Allah. He's covered all his bases. There are no circumstances under which you can change one word of the Quran or any aspect of Islam at all. And if you do, you are an apostate and guilty to the extent that you can be killed by any other Muslim. So that's why we see so few Muslim reformers. And if anybody did try and reform Islam and that took off in any way, what you'd have left would not be Islam. It would be something else because of this doctrine that says Islam is perfect and cannot be reformed. And, you know, Muslims say, well, why would you want to reform perfection? Does it mean that, you know, there was something wrong with what there was before? Well, there can't be because Islam is perfect because the Quran tells you.
The perfect man. Yeah.
But of course, that's not to say that people don't recognise that there's a problem. It's just they can't speak out and say it. And one of the things that Sheikh Qaradawi, Al-Qaradawi, I think, said not too long ago, he was one the guy who was head of the Muslim Brotherhood for a good period of time. Don't know if he still is. But anyway, he's a well-known name in the Muslim world, and he was head of Muslim Brotherhood when he said this. He said, if it were not for the fact that Islam has the death sentence for apostasy, he said it would have crumbled into dust a long time ago because you can't even leave Islam without bringing a death sentence upon you, which is something we see all around the Islamic world all the time, in conjunction with this fact that you can't reform Islam because you can't reform perfection. People who want to leave Islam also find it very hard to do because they incur the wrath of their family, their friends, their colleagues, and they can be killed by any other devout Muslim if they're in a Muslim country. And even if they're in a Western country, they can be killed by devout Muslims who consider that their actions have brought dishonor upon them, upon the family. So if it were not for the fact that apostasy was punishable by death, said Sheikh Qaradawi, Islam would have crumbled into dust 1,000 years ago. And that's a very, very telling thing for him to have said. And it's something that we, you know, we ought to bear in mind, that we, you know, Islam cannot be reformed. People will not leave it in large numbers because they're too scared. And all we can do at this stage is to invoke our sense of self-preservation and say we are going to have to protect ourselves against Islam, which might well involve prohibiting it from the public space, reclassifying it as a political ideology, which is something that Paul Alexander suggested in the chat room earlier, and something that I'm seriously considering taking further forward as we go on, not on this show, but I mean as we go down the road, because I think we have to completely rethink the way that we we look at Islam, if we continue to look at it as just another religion, we're always going to be in trouble, because we have guaranteed freedom of religion to to religions. But what we need to do is define what is a religion and what is not. In my view, one of the things that makes a religion is the fact that they follow the golden rule. And every religion in the world does this, the golden rule being that treat others as you would treat yourself, you know, do as you would be done by, or, you know, don't do to other people what you wouldn't have done to yourself. Variations on that theme. That is the golden rule. Islam does not follow that. Islam divides the world into two. It divides it into Darul Harb, the land of war, and Darul Islam, lands ruled by Islam. And Islamic doctrine says Darul Islam is always going to have to be at war with Darul Harb until Darul Harb, the lands ruled by infidels, is conquered, and everybody lives under Islamic rule. That's not to say everybody becomes a Muslim, but everybody lives under Islamic rule. And if you're not a Muslim, you're a third-class citizen. And if you don't accept that and pay the jizya, we'll kill you, you know. And that is the goal that every devout Muslim, every able-bodied devout Muslim must try and bring about to the best of his ability. Every single able-bodied devout Muslim in the world must do this if he is going to earn the brownie points that he will get when he needs when he goes to paradise in order to get hold of all them virgins. He is going to have to do this in his life in order to be a good Muslim. And people are going to have to realize that this is the case. Every single Muslim in the world, if they're devout and able-bodied, they have to do this. Of course, there are a lot of people out there who are Muslim in name only, and they don't want to get involved in any of this stuff, but they are irrelevant. They are of no consequence, because if you think back in history, in Germany in World War II, most Germans were peaceful, but a small number of Nazis took the country into war, and the end result was millions, tens of millions of people died. In Russia in the 20th century, most Russians were peaceful, but Stalin and all the other leaders who brought about communism and Marxism took the country into decades of war and poverty, and tens of millions of Russians were killed. Same with China. Most Chinese in the 20th century were peaceful, but Mao Zedong and his cadre of, I won't say they're fanatics, but the people who led communist China at that time, took tens of millions of people to their death, because they didn't. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. That's what I'm trying to say. And it's exactly the same with Islam. We may have peaceful Muslims who don't want to get involved with this stuff, but that's not the point. The point is that Islam as an ideology is poisonous. It's based on lies and deceit. It's designed not to be reformed. It's designed in such a way that Muslims are obliged to promote lies and deceit to the rest of us in order for us to accept it into our country. Is that a way that we want to go forward? I say, well, no, it isn't. But rather than sort of harp on this topic for too much longer, Kel, I know you wanted to talk next about the ISIS women's brigades in Iraq and Syria, so I'm going to hand the microphone back to you.
Thanks, Tim. And I do. And this is from Jihad Watch, and what I'll do is I'm going to put the link right in the chat room so that people can file this and they can read it fully for themselves later. And let's do that right now. There we go. This is rather disturbing to me, Tim, and that this is inspiring piety by means of terror. One of the women in the brigade came over, pointing her firearm at me. She then tested my knowledge of prayer, fasting, and hijab. She was quoted as saying, "In Raqqa, an all-female ISIS brigade cracks down on local women." This is from Ahmad al-Bari of Syria Deeply. This is reported from July 15th of this month. What is their mandate here? Well, to apprehend civilian women who do not follow the organization's strict brand of Sharia law. Now, shortly after the Sunni militant group, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, i.e. ISIS, retook control of Raqqa earlier this year, it created Al-Qansas Brigade, an all-female unit operating in the city. Its purpose is to apprehend civilian women in Raqqa who do not follow the organization's strict brand of Sharia law, including a mandate that all women be fully covered in public and that they be accompanied by a male chaperone. Quote, unquote, "We have established the brigade to raise awareness of our religion among women and to punish women who do not abide by the law." This is from Abu Ahmad, an ISIS official in Raqqa. "There are only women in this brigade. We have given them their own facilities to prevent the mixture of men and women." I really don't think I need to read a whole lot more from this article. Everything we're trying to accomplish in restoring freedoms for women under the thumb of Sharia law, what I have been trying to do for the last 5 years, I come across this story. This was updated July 19th. This was updated 2 days ago. Everything I have, my strivations, are they all in vain? I am very, very, very disheartened by this, to say the least, and I'll try to keep it as civil as I possibly can. But when these stories come across our desk, mine and Tim's, and we read them, and we see that women have no problem with the Sharia law, then what are we accomplishing in terms of freedoms? As Tim alluded to earlier in the program, they have no comprehension of Western democracies. These women, if you click on that link I put in the chat room, you'll see a photo of these women dressed to the hilt in their Sharia-clad finery holding AK-47s. This is not what I bargained on when I wanted to help the women and children under the thumb of Islam. This is not what I feel my mission statement is anymore. My mission statement when I first started fighting Islam was to help the women and the children. But at this point, I have washed my hands. If these women want to live under the thumb of Sharia, underneath an Islamic regime, so be it. That is theirs to bear. I can do nothing for them. I am over it. I'm done. My sole mission statement now, as Kel Fritzy of the Red Fox Blogger and Radio Jihad Network, is to inform you that I am determined as an individual, as Tim, as an individual, that we are going to go after Islam full bore. And if that includes casualties of war, which would include women and children, so be it. This is it. This is the final straw for me. This is ISIS. They have now shortened themselves to IS, and that is simply Islamic state, and the women are going for this. I've had enough. Tim's had enough. You should have had enough by now as well. And Tim, I'll pass that back to you.
Well, there's no question that we're not going to achieve a lot if we were to head into Syria this time, you know, armed with our Western good intentions and sort of marched up to a couple of these women and said, "I say, young lady, did you know there's a different way of doing things?" Especially while they're wearing that very attractive Sharia uniform and carrying those AK-47s, I don't think we would last too long at all. And I mean, I'm being flippant, obviously, but the point is that we're not going to get through to the mindset of people who have subscribed to Sharia to that extent, and who have been empowered to impose Sharia on other people in their country. You know, they've been told that doing this thing is for the greater glory of Allah, and they've been given the uniform, and they've been given AK-47s with obviously, well, hopefully, the instructions on how to use them. And they are, well, quite. And they are going around terrorizing their fellow countrymen or countrywomen, and there's going to be no changing hearts and minds at this stage. Okay, so if we're going to tackle this at all, it's going to have to to be from an entirely different point of view. And the way I feel we ought to attack it is by, first of all, informing absolutely everybody when we hear of these things happening. We ought to bring it to people's attentions. All right, we can't necessarily do anything about that particular set of circumstances in a way that's going to make a practical difference in the short term. But what we can do is inform our fellow man and say, if you do not what is happening in your country right now, this is what is in line. People with guns will come along and impose Sharia on you and your family. And if you resist, you will be killed, your family will be killed, and your country will be entirely transformed. And we have to make this entirely clear to everybody that this is the course that our political elites are taking us down, and that we do not want it to happen. I certainly don't want it to happen. I know you don't. And I believe there's a large number of people out there who don't want it to happen, but don't know quite what we should be doing. And the very first thing we should be doing is to inform ourselves of exactly what the nature of the problem is. The next thing we should be doing is pressuring our political elites not to accept it anymore. And by not accepting it, I'm talking about taking Islam out of the public space. I'm talking about reclassifying it as a political ideology rather than a religion. I'm talking about enshrining the right to criticize Islam, to come to everybody as natural as breathing. You know, so that when, you know, like just now, if you were to go out and criticize, you know, Nazism, for example, you struck up a conversation with somebody down at your local shop or somebody, you know, anybody, while you're out and about, and say, well, you know, Nazism was a really bad thing, wouldn't you agree? You know, pretty much everybody would say, yeah, Nazism was a bad thing. I mean, same, you know, with fascism and totalitarianism. If you got into a conversation with somebody, I mean, most people know enough about fascism and totalitarianism to say, yeah, they're bad things. We know they're bad things because they're accepted in the public consciousness as bad things. And we have to get that to be accepted about the political ideology of Islam as well. And it isn't going to happen overnight, but education is one of the first things. And to make it clear to our political elites that it is no longer going to be acceptable to appease Muslims in the name of Islam because of the consequences of what happens when Muslims are offended. We're just going to have to say to Muslims, if you're going to be offended, you will be brought to book with the full extent of the law. And if it means imposing draconian restrictions on what Muslims can and can't do, then so be it. The political will isn't there yet, but I'm hopeful that it will be in the not-too-distant future, and maybe sooner than we think, because the riots in France that Paul Alexander put in his link in the chat room, you know, they are going to be pointing up what can happen when you've got a bunch of angry Muslims living in your midst. But rather than develop that subject any further at the moment, I know you want to play a promo, so I'm going to pass the microphone back to you, Kel.
And, Tim, I don't believe this. We are so much running out of time again. I might buy into a premium program where we can do this for 3 hours. But I want to play a clip, and I'm playing this in particular because there's a gentleman gracing our chat room, and that's Dana Smearman, and what he is doing for the American troops is unbelievable. What Bigfoot and moving forward, Paul Alexander, Vito Esposito, Vorpalbyte, what all these people do to stand up for patriotism is unreal. What Sue from New Mexico does for patriotism is unreal. What you and I do is unbelievable. But I'm very, very proud of this particular project, and this is from our friend Allison. She works tirelessly, as does Michael Green, although his organization is a different one. But this is Allison's organization, and this is a voiceover with Dana Smearman.
For many of our vets, the real battle is only beginning. With high unemployment, post-traumatic stress disorder, and life-altering injuries, coming back to civilian life can be a difficult journey. We can't wait for the government to solve the problems our veterans face. we must help those who have given so much in defense of our freedom. Unforgotten Heroes is an organization dedicated to assisting our veterans in whatever way is needed in their transition back to civilian life. Please visit unforgottenheroes.org to find out what you can do to help. You can also find Unforgotten Heroes on Facebook. And remember, no hero should ever be forgotten.
And let's be that a hero to save us. I'm not gonna say.
And we want to thank Dana Smearman for that. And, of course, we want to thank her, sweet Allison, for that as well. We have had some wonderful people joining us, Tim, in the chat room. Bigfoot, Dana. We've had numerous guests, one of them of whom is Terry. Moving forward, Paul Alexander, Vito Esposito, and Vorpal Bite, and, of course, Sweet Sue from New Mexico, who is listening on the line. Just a few programming notes for you folks out there. Okay, first of all, the immediate programming note, please get to Radio Jihad Network tonight with Vito Esposito at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, where he has as his guest Claire Lopez. Please try to be there. We also want to apprise you that Tim and myself were back better than ever after being refreshed from well-deserved vacations. And tomorrow night, we will be interviewing the proprietors of the British Patriot Alliance. So please tune in for that. That is the Freedom Loving Infidels. That's Tim and myself tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. We also invite you to listen to Mike Holt of Restore Australia, heard on Red Fox Blogger Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Thursday, we have a brand new show, and this includes myself, Tim, and Agador. It's called Islam Exposed. That it will be 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday. And then, of course, you can listen to the ravings of a mad fox as she's unleashed and left on her own Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You guys really make all of this worthwhile to do because we are making a difference one voice at a time. And as Jeff says on his show over there at EDL Radio, in which I produce, if it weren't for you, there would be no us. Tim and myself are eternally grateful for your patronage and how you share the shows. We appreciate those that take time out of their otherwise busy days to spend with us, and we appreciate those that listen and archive. Thank you very much. And, Tim, we've got, like, 4 minutes of talking points left.
I know. Doesn't time fly when you're enjoying yourself? We have indeed. I've really enjoyed the show tonight, Kel. It's been wonderful to be back after a few weeks' holiday. We should have a holiday more often, I think. It's so nice when you sort of come back and get into the saddle. I do hope our listeners have enjoyed it as well. Obviously, we're going to be back full guns blazing over the next few weeks with the various topics that we are presented with Islam, but because, of course, Islam is the gift that never stops giving, as we always like to say. But yes, if you've got a particular point to raise and you'd like to sort of dial in for the last couple of minutes, you'll have to be quick. Otherwise, Kel, what have we got to close us off with?
Our usual closing song. But you're right. I have enjoyed this show immensely, and I have been enthralled with the conversation. We've covered a lot of ground. Ladies and gentlemen, it was kind of like we're still decompressing from our respective vacations. It's kind of like, well, what are we going to do today? I don't know. What do you want to do? But you know what? When Tim and I get together, believe me, there is always something on the front burner that is entertaining, informative, and leaves you with more homework to do. This is what we strive to do. You guys, we give you the tools, you do the homework, and educate others, because it's mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. And Islam is a political entity. Right, Tim?
Well, it certainly is, and I think if there was one thing that I'd want to drum home into the heads of our political elites and anybody in authority who thinks it's a religion and wants to treat it accordingly, is just remember, it is not. It is a political ideology that hides behind a thin veneer of religion in order to impose a totalitarian agenda of world domination on the rest of us. And if you commit that to memory and bring it out whenever you get the opportunity, eventually the world will become a much better place. But in the meantime, do tune in and listen to the shows that we have for you with Red Fox. Red Fox, Kel Fritzi and myself on Mondays. Kel, of course, has her own flying solo show on Fridays when we have Freedom Loving Infidel on Tuesdays. And yes, we might just have a little something for you on Thursday as well. So stay tuned for that. And we hope to bring you a lot more about Islam and the various ways in which you, the listener, can help us spread the word. And with that, over to you, Kel, and I'll let you tie things up with we'll speak again very soon.
We most certainly will. And Tim, I'm so glad that we're both back in our respective seats on Monday, and we will be as well on Tuesday. I'm looking very svelte and tanned. But I am rested.
You have got those Louis Vuitton shoes that you were talking about.
That's right, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we went
fishing, people, yeah. And I caught a shoe. Damn.
Yeah. I was going to say, not a lot of people know this, but Kel is a champion angler, and she didn't just catch any old shoe. It was a Louis Vuitton. And I said, if you can catch the other one, you can take it down and sell it for about $500 at a local market. So, you know. Yeah, wonderful job there, Kel. And yes, you're looking very nice and tanned after your week away.
So, there you go.
Yes,
I'll be speaking with you a little later. We'll be going over show notes as usual. Tim, great to have you back. Great to be back with you as usual. I look forward to tomorrow evening at the Radio Jihad Network. Once again, though, people, listen to Vito Esposito tonight as he interviews Claire Lopez at 6 p.m. That's a little and over an hour. Make sure you're there. Tim, I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon, Kel. And thanks again, listeners, for dropping in. And we hope to be speaking to you again very, very soon. Bye for now. Bye for now, Kel.
Bye for now. Talk to you later, Tim.
Yeah.
Keep hope alive.
Sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb. Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had to give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive, until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, want your foolish pride, want your beautiful joy, even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood, they create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats, if you respect over a thousand men, gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna fall.
looking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Well, here's to you, two shots of whiskey, one Jameson, one Johnny Powers. From Coney Island to Seaside Heights, Long Beach, Freeport, the Lower East Side, Massive people to Sheepshead Bay, a city island to the Rockaway, Tower Beach and Tottenville, Midland, Belmar, up and down to Sayerville, Broad Channel never lost her will, and Breezy Point, we will be back. We never lost our will, survive.
We'll be right back.